As the 20th century progressed, we find ourselves confronted with the paradoxical spectacle of tremendous scientific advance and thus improvement in quality of patient care on the one hand, and a horrific regression in terms of bioethical principles revealed at the Nuremberg trials after World War II on the other. Let's begin with the scientific advances, which had the effect of encouraging people to continue their deep-seated trust and deep-seated abiding expectations of the medical community in terms of what it could provide and of the extent to which it could be relied upon to improve the lot of human beings. In section number two, we look first at antimicrobials, that is to say drugs that fight bacteria and other microbes, and intravenous therapy. And in section number 2.1, one of the first effective antimicrobials, drugs that specifically affect the growth of bacteria, are the sulfa drugs, which were the result of experiments in the dye industry in Germany. And Gerhard Johannes Paul Domach was one of the first to recognize and then to try to make use of what was perceived as being the bacteriostatic, the inhibitory effect of a drug which was called Prontosil, and which was again a result of the research that they had been doing on dyes. It was noted sort of coincidentally that this compound was effective against streptococcal infections in mice, not because it killed the bacteria, but because it prevented them from growing, from dividing, which if you can stop the bacteria from growing, then the body's natural immune system will, unless it's been an overwhelming infection, be able to take care of them. So the effect of this was to actually be of value to people who were infected with staphylococcal or streptococcal infections. However, and this was the case in a number of experiments in the 19th and in the 20th century, he was not able to obtain permission or go through the necessary process of working through what would be necessary in order to get a human a study of this drug. And as it happened, in 1932, his own daughter contracted a very severe infection as a result of cutting her hand, and he gave her Prontosil. He gave her this sulfanilamide, this sulfa drug, and she made a complete recovery. He did not reveal this to the scientific world until many years later for fear that it would be regarded as unprofessional and dangerous, which, of course, from the standpoint of human experimentation, it was. One might notice in parentheses that in 1935 he was awarded the Nobel Prize, but the National Socialist government in Germany refused to allow him to receive it. There's a little bit of irony in the widespread use of sulfa drugs during World War II, and that is that one of the places where they were most lauded, most praised, was following the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was thought that the liberal use of sulfa drugs saved the limbs of many soldiers and sailors who would otherwise have succumbed to gangrene infections, infection with Clostridium perfringens, the drug, the organism that normally causes gangrene. In retrospect, again, although sulfa drugs were widely used, and sometimes to excess, because there are significant side effects of these drugs, it's probable that the lack of, or the decreased number of servicemen who had to undergo amputations after Pearl Harbor had less to do with sulfa drugs than with the fact that the grass on which the healthcare workers were forced to place the injured sailors and soldiers had not really been infected with Clostridium organisms to the extent that the battlefields of Europe are. The battlefields of Europe, the soil of Europe, is heavily infected with this organism, which has the ability to form a spore and survive for long periods of time. Simply because most European fields have been battlefields at one time or another and have had the unfortunate experience of human blood and remains being buried in them. However, this was not necessarily the case on the hills above Pearl Harbor, and so it's possible that sulfa drugs, although they got the reputation for being life-saving, were actually not the primary factor in the observation that the soldiers had done so well. Nevertheless, these drugs were very widely used during World War II, and particularly in Europe, they were effective, although again there were problems with the side effects when they were overused. The next category of drugs with which we're perhaps more familiar in 2.2, the antibiotics, which don't just inhibit growth but can actually kill off organisms, depending on which one one's talking about. The first antibiotic to be described was penicillin, and it was described by Alexander Fleming, an English physician, who noticed purely accidentally that a petri dish, a dish containing a culture of organisms of streptococci, were not growing as readily as he thought they would, and in fact they seemed to have been inhibited on one section of a plate which he was about to throw away because it had been contaminated with a mold, perhaps been left open a little longer than it ought to have been, but he noticed that the inhibition was from the mold itself. And as a result of this observation and further testing, it was determined that the mold itself was secreting a substance which was keeping the bacteria at bay. There was not the technology necessary to produce penicillin in large quantities in Britain at this time during the war, and so it really wasn't until later in the 1940s, and especially in the United States, that penicillin manufacture became rather widespread. And initially it was a very precious drug available only in limited supply because you had to have huge vats of mold grown in order to acquire a very, very small amount of the drug itself. Nowadays, of course, it's produced synthetically. And of course, there are quite a large number of drugs that have been observed to inhibit or stop the growth of microorganisms, also from similar mold products, and quite a number of chemical changes have been deliberately induced in the compounds that are synthesized in order to try to create new antibiotics, because, as we know, antibiotic resistance is a phenomenon that is virtually universal. And part of the reason for this is quite simply the fact that when we make use of the battle between molds and bacteria as a means of trying to wage our own battles against bacteria, we are stepping into a war that is millions of years old. The molds have been producing these compounds and modifying them over tremendously long periods of time, and the bacteria have been evolving ways of developing resistance to them. So it's not a question of the resistance necessarily being spontaneously mutated in the bacterial colonies. It's just that our reliance on these compounds is reliance on what you might call chemical warfare that worked at one point many, many thousands or millions of years ago, fell into somewhat abeyance, and then only became the province of a very few molds, and the secret weapon against it was only known by a few bacteria. But if they are widely used, then of course these capacities to resist the drugs themselves become widespread, and so the longer an antibacterial agent is used, the longer an antibiotic is used, and the more widely it is used, the more rapidly resistance to it develops. This is a continual problem for general practitioners and, of course, for surgeons who, in the context of general practice, one often finds people insisting on being given antibiotics when they don't need them. And the easiest thing to do is to simply capitulate. The reality, however, is that in so doing, you're actually increasing the problem of the future lack of susceptibility to these compounds that that one would wish were there. So it's a constant problem within medicine. If we drop down to number 2.3, the subject of intravenous therapy, yet another very important positive advance for medicine. However, although it existed and was known and was described in a practical way since the early 1800s, it was not widely used in any context, although it had particular value for diseases like cholera, where you have tremendous losses of fluids from the person who's affected. It really was not widely used until the first quarter of the 20th century, its usefulness, that is, the usefulness of keeping a person fluid, expanded, was still being debated as early as World War I. But now, of course, it's absolutely necessary and widely used within medicine, and indeed, one of the definitions of whether or not a person has had a serious illness, at least as far as the lay population is concerned, is did they start an IV? That would be the definition of whether or not one's illness was significant. If we now drop down to number three, we move from significant and important scientific advances to the horror of the discovery of what had happened in the scientific community among the Axis powers, primarily in Germany, at least as far as the reporting went, but in fact it was as widespread, the misuse of the models of science and the performance of horrific and almost demonic experiments was not confined to Germany. It was also present to the same degree in Japan, but for a variety of political and economic reasons. It was only revealed to the public in the form of publicizing the Nuremberg trials, what had gone on in Europe and in Germany in particular. It was not until relatively recently that details of these the experimentation that took place during World War II in the countries under Japanese domination were revealed. But the phenomenon is the same. And that is that as society began to be less and less skeptical of medicine, as the question of autonomy shifted from an autonomous patient to a medical establishment that expected and even demanded obedience, a public began to comply for the simple reason that medicine seemed to be making such tremendous advances and improving the lot of humanity. The Nuremberg trials were a horrifying revelation of how this expectation could be misused and how the medical establishment in itself, that is, in the nature of science, does not possess the safeguards that would prevent the misuse of and even the sadistic employment of the methods of scientific inquiry in ways that are morally repugnant and objectionable. If we drop down, and we will consider this question in more detail when we look at our section on informed consent later in the course, so we'll be looking over this, I'm afraid, rather quickly and superficially. The Nuremberg trials were a unique phenomenon in that there was no legal precedent for trying a body of individuals, many of whom had simply been obeying the laws of their country, laws which had been passed according to the legal requirements of that nation. How do you condemn a person for a crime when, in fact, according to the standards of their nation, they were not only not engaging in a crime, but were, in fact, doing precisely what the government demanded or expected of them, and in some cases was threatening them that they must do in order to avoid prison themselves? So the Nuremberg trials were a complex legal experiment which raised the possibility of the idea of crimes against humanity, that there were some acts which were themselves so fundamentally evil that they could be tried irregardless of whether or not the individuals could rightly claim that they were following the laws of their nation. Now, we'll note parenthetically that one of the ironies of the Nuremberg trials, particularly against the medical researchers who were condemned for their policy of sterilization, were embarrassed by the fact that the defense attorneys were able to point out that many of the same policies were being practiced in the United States and indeed encouraged by very notable and otherwise heroic regarded political figures in the U.S. But nevertheless, the Nuremberg trials were a revelation to the world of the horrors of medical experimentation, so-called, that had been going on in Europe especially, and in Germany in particular, in places like Mauthausen in Austria, which was a camp primarily given over to these dreadful so-called experiments. Many of them yielded no scientific data at all that could be used because everyone was under pressure to produce data that would support the government's policies, and any sort of information that seemed to be conflicting with that would be rejected or could get the experimenters in trouble. And so the later question about the morality or the ethics of making use of the data that had been collected in many cases is moot, because the data is itself unclear and in some cases represents the suppression of data that, that would be necessary to evaluate in order to determine whether or not a thing actually happened or was of value. So what one found at the Nuremberg trials were that people had been subjected to what were called medical experiments, although many of them were performed by people with very little, if any, scientific training, who seemed to be satisfying their sadistic impulses rather than attempting to acquire any information, that this was done to people against their will, that it involved things that caused death and mutilation and grave harm. So one of the things that came out, if you drop down to number 3.2 of Nuremberg, were 10 principles of what were called the Nuremberg Code that were then regarded as normative for any kind of scientific experimentation that would follow afterwards. And it really is the basis of the codes of informed consent which we have today. And if we look at these very briefly, number one emphasizes that voluntary consent of the subject is absolutely essential. The individual should know what is going to happen, what are the options, and to know what the alternatives are. The person must not be under pressure to accept. In number two, the experiment should be expected to yield fruitful results, not just something trivial or something that hasn't been well established scientifically. In particular, number three, it should be done on the basis of previous experimentation using animals. Number four, should avoid unnecessary physical and mental suffering and injury. Number five is rather ironic. It states that it should not happen that death or disabling injury would be expected results unless the physicians who are conducting the experiment are themselves willing to serve as subjects. If we drop down then to number 9, the subject should always have the right to stop the experiment at any point, and indeed, number 10, the scientists themselves should be willing to stop if it's clear that this is going to result in harm to the individual. Well, these principles were embraced, if we look now at number 3.3, clearly by the Catholic Church, by Pope Pius XII, who, in the course of many of his audiences, addressed a large number of bioethical and medical questions to an extent that none of his predecessors had done before him. So in 1952, he notes almost in passing that a physician can take no measure to try any course of action, without the consent of the patient. So he's extending the idea that was primarily focused on experimentation to anything. The physician can take no measure, no course of action, without the consent of the patient. So this would certainly be the characteristic of informed consent today, that indeed all medical procedures, experimental or not, require the informed consent of the subject, presuming that the person is capable of giving consent. And the moral limit, here in number 12 in this address, the moral limit to the doctor's action is taken with the consent of the patient. So the patient must consent, and that is morally required by the physician. He emphasizes, the Pope does in number 13, that the patient themselves is a user and not a proprietor of his own body. So the patient does not have unlimited power to destroy his own or mutilate his own body and its functions. So one is limited in terms of the number of things one consent to by the fact that our bodies are not entirely our own. And he concludes in number 14, the patient has no right to involve physical or psychic, that is psychological, integrity in experiments or research if they entail serious destruction, mutilation, wounds, or perils. So Pius XII is accepting and even extending the principles that were articulated at the Nuremberg trials following World War II.